This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. I'm pleased to have Dr. Michelle Wang with me today. She's Assistant Professor of English at Nanyang Technological University in Singapore. She's also the author of Eternalized Fragments, Reclaiming Aesthetics in Contemporary World Fiction with Ohio University Press. And it is for this book that she joins us here today. Welcome, Dr. Wang, and thank you for accepting my invitation.
Thanks so much, Gargi, for having me. I'm very grateful to have the opportunity to share my work.
Thank you. As always, I would like to start with the genesis of this book. What inspired you to write this book?
So I suppose much of the work that I do is often trying to answer the broad question of what it means to treat literature as a work of art, as one might a painting, for example, or how I might be able to convey or to translate the experiences that I have with reading particular works of fiction, or whether I find the experience wrenching or transformative, or basically that whole range of experiences that we typically term an aesthetic experience. And to really try to answer these very broad questions in as specific ways as possible. And I should add that I don't think there's only one way to answer the question. In fact, the subject would probably be pretty dull if it could be answered so easily to everyone's satisfaction. And to be fair, I'm not always necessarily satisfied with my own answers. So I guess I see much of the work that I do as trying to improve the quality of these responses to try to do justice to the diverse ways that we can account for these types of experiences and to say something about the value of that approach. And like many other scholars' first books, so the more recent version of my book's Genesis story is tied to that process of transforming my PhD dissertation into a more comprehensive and hopefully insightful book project. But I guess the longer Genesis story is that I've been interested in this question of how we might address the issue of aesthetics, which we typically think about a little bit more in relation to things like visual arts. But I'm particularly interested in its relevance for literature for about a decade or so now. And my interest in the topic was actually sparked by a course that I took as an MA student. So at the time in my department, the course in literary approaches was co-taught by five different professors. And there were these 2 weeks in which one of the professors taught an aesthetics approach. And those 2 weeks of the semester actually ended up changing the entire direction of my MA project and eventually shaped my PhD topic. So, and of course, the way I've thought about the subject has evolved as I write more widely, but it continues to be, I think, informed by many of the questions that I started thinking about 10 years ago and trying to perhaps answer them better or more conscientiously and in response to the research that I've read.
Thank you for your answer. One of the assumptions that we have is that literary criticism generally tends to ignore aesthetics when we analyze contemporary literature. And critics tend to focus on concepts that come from political and social theory. To what extent do you think this argument is justified? And in what ways can we reclaim aesthetics, if this is true, for our analysis today?
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question, Gargi. I think in part that this push toward an anti-aesthetic is linked to many of the issues that you've just raised. I think increasingly scholars who are interested in questions of aesthetics are also seeing that perhaps the more traditional or conventional ways in which we have approached aesthetics that may perhaps tend to neglect sociopolitical dimensions of the novel, which can be very central to in fact, its aesthetic strategies, is no longer sufficient. So I think that there are many scholars who are currently working to try to blend the two approaches. So I think the two approaches do have sort of a different emphasis. There are many scholars who are also trying to blend these particular dimensions of the types of analysis that that you've been talking about, sociopolitical, sociocultural, that focus on these particular dimensions and to blend it into their work. I think so. Last year, I read a really good book. I think it was by Caroline Levine, who talks about title is escaping me right now, but I think the title of the book is On Form, and she talks about how traditional concepts of wholeness, of rhythm, of hierarchy has been sort of transformed when we take all of these other issues into account.
And the second part is like, how do we, for example, as critics, as literary critics, find a space for aesthetics in our criticism? Is this through the cognitive approach that you have taken, or are there different ways available and we can choose the one that suits us best?
That's a difficult question in some ways, but I guess it's always quite interesting to me because I came to literature a little bit later in my career. So my BA was in a different subject, and I made the switch to English in my MA and my PhD. So to me, aesthetics is the main reason why I read fiction. It's why I got into the field in the first place. So it's always, I didn't know, of course, that was the term that I would use to characterize why I loved literature. But that was the reason that I got into literature. So it's always sort of slightly odd to me that aesthetics might be thought of as incompatible with what literary studies does. But of course, you're absolutely right, because this sort of push against or what they call a sort of anti-aesthetic turn is very much present in many of the sort of approaches that characterize late 20th century literary studies. So it's been sort of a process of trying to navigate my own, preferences with sort of what theory says, and trying to find a way to sort of mediate those two experiences. Because to me, aesthetics is sort of the main reason why I'm in the field. So it's always slightly strange. I guess in the same way that to someone else who is invested in a different approach, it would be very strange that sociocultural dimensions of the book are not at the center of my concerns. So I think that there are a whole array of approaches, and that all of our different investments in different aspects of the text actually make for the diversity and the richness of the field. And I learned so much from reading what other scholars who don't necessarily have the same approach that I do have to say, and that informs my work in part. But for me, I guess aesthetics is sort of fundamental to my experience of literature. So I can't imagine doing literary criticism in terms of my own work, without thinking about aesthetics. It's a quite a strange experience for me.
I also want to tease out, do you see if there is a contradiction between these two approaches, or do you think that's not a contradiction, that's just a difference of approaches, difference of opinions, difference of ways of looking at the work of fiction?
I don't think it needs to be a contradiction. I think I'm leaning more towards that sort of second approach that you're talking about, which is that aesthetics gives us a set of I guess tools to be thinking about dimensions of the text that are not necessarily as prevalent in other kinds of approaches to literature. So I see them as sort of complementary, I think it has its own perhaps shortcomings that are perhaps better captured by other approaches. And I also actually, I suspect, I mean, I'm not sure if this is actually true because aesthetics is so central to what I do, but I also suspect that different types of texts lend themselves well to different types of approaches, depending on the sort of emphasis and perhaps in some ways where the novelist was sort of going with the book. So I do think that there are different types of texts that lend themselves to different approaches. And it's in particular when, I'm always especially interested when texts that are dominantly read through one particular frame that may not necessarily be how I connected with the book. So I may be learning something new, but that's not... it doesn't characterize my sort of readerly response. And in part, I guess that's what I'm trying to address with the selection of particular texts that perhaps have a strong sociopolitical or strong sociocultural dimension in the novels that I chose to address in my book.
Can you give an example? Because this is very interesting. What kind of a text do you think best exemplifies as a text lends itself to this kind of criticism? Yeah.
Sure. So I think the two main examples that come to mind are Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude, which I discuss in the coda of my book, as well as Arundhati Roy's The God of Small Things. So both of these novels are texts where when I was reading into the previous scholarly work that had been done in these areas, primarily, they have very strong aspects of post-colonial criticism. So, and I think those kinds of, that there are ways in which that kind of criticism can be done that can be very insightful and interesting. But I also think that when we sort of, I guess, attend to some dimensions of the text, the main reasons why I connected with the books, I don't really sort of see that response being addressed in much of the criticism that I read. And in part, my book was trying to address these particular dimensions.
Thank you. That does answer my question. Your book synopsis reads that postmodern and contemporary literature tends to be dominated by disjuncture, paradoxes, and incongruities. And imagine this is what the title of your book refers to, eternalized fragments. Why eternalized? And why do you call them disjunctures, paradoxes, and incongruities? Can you explain them a little to us?
Sure. I should admit that the phrase actually comes from Marquez. So his book is the one that I examined in the coda. And it actually, I liked the possibilities of the phrase and the context in which it appears in Marquez's novel. So I actually quote that in the epigraph of the introduction. And I found it to be a good fit with the sort of tensions that I detected between fiction and theory of this particular period. So what we do often find in the theory of this period is this sort of anti-aesthetic emphasis. So for instance, someone like Walter Benjamin has written about the sort of dangers of the aestheticization of politics, for example. So in the theory, there seems to be a great push for against aesthetics, I suppose. And yet, so much of the literature of this period I found extremely aesthetically satisfying. So I was trying to sort of address the sort of tensions that I saw here. And in particular, this idea of the fragmentary is quite prevalent in many of the postmodernist and contemporary texts that I look at in this book. So, for example, Jennifer Egan's A Visit from the Goon Squad features a whole series of character narrators. And it takes on, it plays with different types of narrative voice. It plays with first person, third person, second person in one of the chapters. And so it's fragmentary in that sense of the word. But my sense of it was that the fragmentary doesn't necessarily need to be ugly or dissonant or unaesthetic, I suppose. But the idea that these fragments are somehow resplendent, that they're somehow enduring, they're somehow aesthetic in quality, seemed to me to capture the heart of the subject matter that I was trying to get at. So another example, this idea of, I think the second part of your question has to do with this idea of the fragmentariness of
contemporary literature. I mean,
right.
I mean, how is this fragmentary special or different from, for example, other epochs of literature? I mean, the fragmentariness, let's just say, of a literature written in any other time. I mean, how is this different from, how is this special to contemporary literature and not others? I mean, what's the difference I am trying to understand?
Okay, so I think there's nothing that's being done in postmodernism that is necessarily altogether highly original in that sense. It's as Brian McHale puts it, the intensity with which it is being done by many writers at a time that makes it so noteworthy or significant. In fact, many of the sort of postmodernist strategies that theorists have identified can be found in the work of someone like Lewis Carroll's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland and so on and so forth. So there are sort of precursors, but it's sort of the intensity with which we see these types of strategies being employed in postmodernist fiction that makes it so unusual or startling or worth examining. I mean, all sorts of interesting things happen in postmodern fiction that would have been quite difficult to conceive of in, or at least would have seemed unusual in an earlier period. But they were being done by numerous writers from different countries at the same time. So for example, Flann O'Brien is one of the writers that I look at. And I think he's sort of, as many scholars have pointed out, one of the early examples of a postmodernist writer. And in his book, we find, I'm thinking here of Ed Swim Tubert's, his first novel, we find this radical flattening of diegetic levels. So you have a manuscript within a manuscript within a manuscript, which is not that unusual in and of itself. But you have characters who sometimes migrate between the diegetic levels. And in one instance, a created character literally tries to kill his author. And this is before, you know, we had Bart and all of the rest of them. So I'm particularly interested in how these sorts of gestures that seem to go against what we traditionally think of as aesthetics in terms of coherence, congruence, symmetry, patterning, how the two subjects can then sort of speak to each other, I suppose.
Yeah, and this leads to very nicely to my next question, is that you analyze these from a cognitive point of view. Can you elaborate your approach? I mean, how does the cognitive understanding of literature helps us analyze these, helps us appreciate this fragmentation, this disjuncture of contemporary literature better?
Sure. Thanks, Gargi. So I think what I tried to do with the sort of cognitive research that I looked at was to try to blend it with my interest in aesthetics. So the way I did that was to sort of set up what I term the sense, moral, and form drives in the book. And so essentially, I'm particularly interested in sort of issues that traditional aesthetics have been interested in for a long time. So something like symmetry, something like patterns, something like form. When we read this in light of what we have now learned about the brain over the last 100 years or so, how do things add up or line up or not? So in particular, for example, the form drive that I talk about in the book actually taps on our brain's tendency for craving patterns, for craving symmetry. So for example, the neuroscientist V.S. Ramachandran has persuasively argued that our brain is hardwired to love solving puzzles, that we love searching for patterns, and that this process of pattern seeking actually generates signals to limbic reward systems, which is then, of course, likely related to our appreciation of devices, literary devices such as alliteration, such as motifs, because these are all types of patterning. So in some sense, it's sort of trying to put together the sort of really interesting research that is being done in the cognitive sciences and seeing, and I guess testing it out with our own experience of reading fiction to see the extent to which some of the stuff holds up or holds true, I suppose. But that's not to say that I don't necessarily mean that we should take research from the cognitive sciences as absolute truth or to treat it unquestioningly where, you know, our literary analysis simply fleshes out these ideas that we've derived from the cognitive sciences. We know, of course, that there are limitations of methodology to any type of research. And in fact, neuroscience is probably one of the fields where scholars and scientists readily reiterate how little we actually know about the brain and how that research is continually changing. And of course, literary studies and especially postmodernism itself warns us against treating scientific and in fact any kind of knowledge unquestioningly, right, to at least express skepticism or to highlight the problems with doing so. But I also think that to talk about aesthetics in ways that ignore or discount what we've learned from the cognitive sciences can be problematic and perhaps a little close-minded. I've always been very fascinated by the moments of convergence where, you know, the types of research that we're reading in the cognitive sciences strikingly illuminates or at least shows how many writers or literary theorists were very much ahead of their time, right? So I think there was one study that I read, I mentioned it in the book, that found that experiences of the sublime and experiences of the beautiful actually reviewed different patterns of brain activity in fMRI scans. And this is an idea that's actually been around for about 300 years in the field of aesthetics. So it's really quite exciting to see how contemporary methods for studying cognition experience are able to enrich the ways that we are thinking about these concepts. Because what the neuroscientists do when they look at these portions of the brain that are engaged is enrich the ways in which we can think about the concepts themselves, right? Because particular parts of the brain are typically associated with functions that we may not necessarily have thought about in sort of aesthetic engagement. So I think it's that sort of two-way traffic between research in the cognitive sciences and aesthetics and narrative theory that I'm particularly interested in exploring.
Yes, and I'm just out of curiosity, I also want to ask if your research also focuses on the applications, for example, when we see these similarities between neuroscience research and our literary concepts. Do you also think about how, for example, literary studies can inform these, or is this something that remains to be explored? I mean, out of curiosity.
Yeah, sure. I think there are actually there are actually already literary theorists and scholars who are actively collaborating with neuroscientists to sort of shape the research in this area. So, for instance, some scholars like Gabriel Starr and Angus Fletcher, many of them they can actually read fMRI scans, and so the collaboration means that they're taking their knowledge and their understanding of literary study to help shape more nuanced sort of experiments for trying to detect these aesthetic experiences in the study of neurobiology, for instance. So I think that's already happening, and it's not work that I'm personally able to undertake, but I think it's already happening, and I think that literary study certainly has a lot to offer the cognitive sciences, and I think that there are numerous cognitive scientists who are very engaged with what literature has to offer in terms of its possibilities for shoring up what we can learn about the brain. So I think, so I mentioned Ramachandran, but there are also a couple of others. Samir Zeki also thinks about this cross-influence between the arts. I'm not sure if it's specifically literature, but he's also thinking about this relationship between studying the brain and the arts. So I think it's already happening in very exciting ways, and what the future holds, I think, remains to be seen. But I'm actually quite excited about much of that research.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Thank you for letting me know. That's something I should also follow on. Now I think I should take a step back, because you had already talked about the drives that you use them in your book to analyze very diverse books. So you talked about the firm drive, but there are other two, which is the moral drive and the sense drive. Can you elaborate them for us so that we can get a sense of how these things function?
Sure. Thanks, Gargi. So I think, as I mentioned, what I'm trying to do is to answer sort of fairly broad questions about, you know, what it means to treat literature as art in as concrete ways as possible. So the model that I'm proposing actually builds on earlier understandings of aesthetics by folks like Immanuel Kant and Friedrich Schiller, and combines that with this more recent research in neuroaesthetics. To suggest that when we think about readerly engagement in the process of reading literature, these three drives seem to be the most relevant. So since the sense drive is sort of related to this idea of open-endedness, it's related to this idea of seeking information in an open-ended way, as Brian Boyd puts it. So in other words, it thrives on change. I link it to sort of what theorists and philosophers have called imagination. And so, because imagination, the research from evolutionary biology suggests that imagination is likely to be crucial to evolution, because the ability to imagine counterfactual scenarios, to make chains of inference, is linked to our ability to adapt to an ever-changing world. So on the one hand, we have the sense drive that has this impulse towards open-endedness and towards generativity. Conversely, the two remaining drives, which are the ones that you asked about, the form drive and the moral drive, I think in turn have the sort of reverse energy, in that they are linked to notions of order, they are linked to notions of unity. So the form drive, earlier I mentioned, taps on our brain's tendency for pattern seeking, for pattern recognition, and the sort of limbic rewards that are associated with them. The moral drive is also, I think, linked to this idea of order. And I was sort of surprised that that was the direction that I eventually went in. But I think it has order-shaping propensities in that, in some sense, I guess, when we think about issues of ethics and morality, we are sort of thinking about ways in which a sort of shared set of conduct or a set of values can be valuable to us as a species, as a whole, in the ways that we interact with each other. And in fact, in some of the discussions of ethics and morality, some of the language tends to draw on concepts such as symmetry. So, for example, the US philosopher John Rawls posits that fairness has to do with this idea of a symmetry of everyone's relations to each other. So this is also, of course, inherent in something like when we think about like the golden rule, right? Doing unto others what we have them do unto us. So it's that symmetry of relations. So I suggest that these are the sort of three key energies that are at work when we engage with literature. And so by identifying the ways in which these three drives interact and how particular modes foreground the workings of particular drives, I try to account for readerly responses and in the ways that we engage with the text. And I guess this is sort of the concrete way, or in as concrete terms as I can possibly work at for trying to really get at this idea of the novel's poetic power, I suppose. These moments that arrest us, that remain in our heads for years and years after, that draw us back to this group of books that we love over and over again. I'm trying to find a way for talking about these moments or in as concrete ways as possible, which is, of course, in and of itself, a hugely ambitious endeavor that is almost always certainly to be found lacking in any single work of analysis, because so many of the great books seem great to us precisely because they seem almost inexhaustible in some ways. So I guess what I do in the book is to try to answer some of these broad questions in as specific ways as I can.
Thank you for your answer. I want to go back. You said that I'm surprised that's the way I took. Why do you say you were surprised at this approach?
So my comment actually relates to this idea that the moral drive is actually a sort of a drive towards order, a drive towards unity, a drive towards congruence. Because I always thought that what we typically group or consider as relating to form, this idea of patterns, this idea of symmetry, I guess I didn't see much that was aligned with what we typically consider sort of moral or ethical concerns in novels. So what I was surprised to discover was, when I was reading the literature and thinking through this material, is how aligned they are, in that they are both, that they both have to do with these ideas of unity, this idea of congruence. And it's a sort of unexpected relation, because I never made that mental move until I started thinking about the drives in this particular way. So that was a mini revelation to me. So my limbic reward structure was being rewarded by that pattern that I detected between the form and moral drives.
This was also very interesting for me because you give examples of the golden rule, of do what you would expect from others, and this idea of symmetry. But these are also very social and political ideas, and they come back in aesthetics in form of a specific drive. And I always wondered, if, for example, this is this attempt of this analysis to subsume in a way, or to have a space for the concern, the social and political concerns that they are there in the books. Is that so, or this is me?
No, I think that's definitely a way to sort of understand how the moral works and how it, that particular dimension of aesthetics work. Although I suppose because different aspects of aesthetics tend to be emphasized at different points. I mean, someone like Kant, for example, in the 18th century was already very interested in this idea of the relationship between aesthetics and ethics. So in some sense, I think it's always been there. But for one reason or another, that particular dimension seems to be underplayed or less attended to. And given the sort of social movements that we've seen in the late 20th century and the sort of renewed concern, and rightly so, importance of these particular subjects, of dimensions of the sociocultural, I certainly think that an approach that is aesthetics oriented but still able to account for these dimensions of the books to the greatest extent possible is especially important. And I do think that the moral drive is one way of trying to address these particular dimensions of the book that perhaps earlier approaches to aesthetics don't quite capture. So in a way, yes, it's sort of sneakily trying to get these ideas of sociocultural, sociopolitical dimensions of the text, which are actually very important to many of the books that I look at. So something like Marquez, like Roy, these concerns are certainly absolutely crucial to the book. So I think it's nice to be able to account for these dimensions of the text, even as my own interest remains sort of rooted to aesthetic concerns.
And that's interesting. I mean, this is my understanding because ethics and post-colonial criticism, for example, would dissociate this moralism from the way it has been imagined in relation to the form drive. I mean, they wouldn't say it's about similarity or it's about order. I mean, these are whole completely new concerns, which are really not about being there being in order. They're more about social justice, recognitions, and things like that. And I'm interested in to know to what extent, for example, in your research, you see emphasis within the constraints of, for example, within the understanding of the moral drive, not associating with the form drive, but having its own way forward. Is there some research, or this is me imagining it.
Yeah, no, sure. That's a really interesting question. I suppose, so the way in which, though I see those similarities between the form and moral drive in that I see them as sort of systems of ordering or unity that sort of counters the sort of open-endedness of the sense drive. I do think that the two drives are doing something that is quite different. It's not quite identical. The example that sort of comes to my mind at this point is the ways in which, so there is this one scene in The God of Small Things, in which the policemen are basically beating one of the characters, Palutha, to death, or close to death. And I was struck by how much of that language emphasized hierarchy, emphasized order, you know, many of the things that we typically associate with something like the form drive. But it's using that sort of language in order to point to the sort of ethically deficient dimensions of that particular moment. So I am interested in the sort of intersections between the two, but I think that it is possible to talk about the moral drive without necessarily falling back into language of the form drive. So in the book, the way that I do this is by tying this up with work in evolutionary psychology. So I draw on Jonathan Haidt's moral foundations theory to think about how it is we might conceive of this idea of a shared, I guess, that's a bit too strong, this notion of how books are challenging or shaping or countering the sort of impulses that we have about ethics and morality. So I think that many of the books that are most interesting are the ones that pose these types of challenges, in which it's not always so easy to see. It's not as straightforwardly didactic. Its moral and ethical complexities are more profound. So I think those actually make for the most interesting novels. And I think that it's possible to address these particular dimensions without necessarily thinking about form. So I do think that the two drives do address quite different dimensions of the text, and they have different implications as well.
Thank you. That really helps me understand. And in coming back to Arundhati Roy, in the chapter where you talk about her, you've also talked about how this approach may help us address some of the post-colonial theoretical violences or misinterpretations. I'm interested to know what you mean by these misinterpretations or violences, and if you can give an example of these.
Sure. So perhaps it'll be helpful for me to first contextualize the remark which I mentioned in the book, which is specifically in relation to some examples of post-colonial readings of the novel. So I guess the word might be a bit mild, but I was disturbed by some of the analysis that I read in the course of researching the book. And I quote bits of that in the book, in which the sort of readings that I guess adhere to a sort of post-colonial approach to the book of regarding characters like Amu or Volutha in particular ways seem to vividly contradict my entire experience of the novel. I wondered at one point, were we reading the same books? It was a very odd experience. I included Roy's novel as one of the 11 books that I look at in my book monograph, not only because Roy's novel allows me to discuss some of these issues, like the sense drive, in particularly nuanced ways, but perhaps a more fundamental criteria, to me at least, in any scholarly work I do, is that I love the novel. I'm absolutely enthralled by the way these writers are using language. And so reading some of the responses to Roy's novel that draw on this post-colonial lens was a very disconcerting experience. This is not to say that an aesthetic approach can only be used to affirm a text value or only to address pleasurable reading experiences. In fact, much of the book, because of the subject matter of postmodernist fiction, it does actually address the subject of disconcerting experiences of reading postmodernist fiction quite extensively. And I think that there are plenty of examples of postcolonial criticism in relation to The God of Small Things that are very valuable. But I'm addressing those criticisms, and those are the ones that I quote in the book, that almost seem to, at times, it seems that you almost have to willfully ignore or neglect what I take to be substantial aspects of what makes The God of Small Things such a wonderful work of literature. You need to actually ignore important aspects of the book in order for that proposed post-colonial reading to work. And I was dissatisfied with some of this analysis because it seemed to not only neglect sort of key instances of textual evidence from the novel, but that the proposed reading flattens the characters and of course, correspondingly, then flattens the complexities of the issues being raised about caste, about gender. And this is what I found extremely problematic. So I think at times, not always, but sometimes, the ways in which some writers use post-colonial criticism, especially when the novel is treated as a sort of fairly straightforward instance of social reflection, can sort of obscure important dimensions of the novel. And I hope that, you know, by attending to and pointing to sort of aesthetic dimensions of the text, it sort of offers a different approach to Roy's novel. There's, of course, also plenty of wonderful scholarship out there about The God of Small Things, but I was trying to address the ones that I found especially disturbing, I suppose, that did not seem to that seemed to completely contradict my experience of reading the book. Because I guess for me, aesthetics is always about the experience with the art object, whether that art object is a work of painting, whether it's a novel, whether it's poetry. So when I read sort of literary analysis that doesn't quite line up with the way, with my own experience of reading the book, I try to sort of examine and account for why this might be the case and how attending to dimensions of the book that I was very taken with might give us a different way into the novel.
If I could ask you to give an example to us so that we can understand this too.
Sure. So let me
criticism
just...
that, for example, ignores important aspects of a book. If not Roy's book, let's just say something if you could think of at the top of your head.
Sure. So I think, since I've already started talking about Roy's book, there, it might be easier to just keep going with that particular example. So I think one of the sort of criticisms that was raised in the book. Let me just have a closer look at some of that so that I'm actually giving the right information. So for instance, one scholar notes that Volutha is represented as a stereotypically beautiful laborer, and that it has to do with an underprivileged man of a lower caste who is sexualized and feminized here. So there are all of these problems, and I agree that there are certainly these sorts of dynamics that speak to the pressures of the caste system that sort of constrain that sort of relationship. But I was very disturbed by the sort of implications of some of this analysis. So I think one scholar said that he considered Amo's sexualized gaze a misuse of erotic capital. He calls it an infantilizing gaze that objectifies Volutha, and this sort of criticism. So this was very odd to me because this was not really my experience of the book. And I think the sort of one of the important implications of this type of reading is that it flattens the character of the Luther, dehumanizes him, and essentially reduces the reading seemed to essentially reduce the characters to primal urges. There didn't seem to be any sense of agency that the characters had, and I found that quite disturbing because I think that part of the strength of the book is, particularly in relation to this relationship in the novel, is it's precisely because these two characters recognized what they were up against, and nonetheless decided to love each other, that partly makes the book so powerful. And so it didn't line up. It didn't line up with my experience of the book, and I wanted to offer a different way of approaching the novel, but also ways that I exemplified by the textual evidence. And so I point to that scene in which they recognize their sort of desire for each other. And that it's a two-way sort of process. So I think thinking about the characters' agency is important to this book, especially given the sort of the pressures of the system in which they live. So I wasn't very satisfied with that particular reading. And so in a sense, this is my response, that when we attend to sort of aesthetic dimensions of the text, what emerges.
Yeah, you're right. And against this, let's just say misreading of post-colonial criticism, how can aesthetics, if you could give us an example, help us appreciate better the dynamics of a book?
Okay, so I think the way in which Roy uses language is quite powerful. I mean, there are so many absolutely beautiful and devastating passages in the novel that remain with me. And I think attending to those particular dimensions of the text forestalls a kind of easy judgment of the characters. It forces us to attend to the layered complexities of the character. So I guess, you know, if one wanted to, one could read Amu as a bad mother who, you know, picks, you know, sexual desire over her children or whatever it is. But I think those are sort of readings that do not attend to the sort of aesthetic dimensions of the text, and that when we attend to these dimensions of the text, it forces us to dwell with its complexities, with its nuances, with how the way in which the stories are told can shift the ways in which we view the world, whether it's the world that is presented to us in the novels or the way in which we interact in our world. So I think it's that attention to nuance, it's that attention to forestalling easy judgment or ready judgment or judgment that sort of can be very quick. I think aesthetics, hopefully I'm sure that there can be very poor aesthetic readings as well, but I think when it's perhaps done in a insightful manner, it can lead us to dwell with these complexities.
Since we are now at the end of the podcast, I'd like to talk to you about your future projects. What are you working on currently?
Thanks for giving me the chance to share that. At present, I'm working on two projects, I suppose. The first is a book chapter on contemporary Irish fiction. So I've been reading and rereading many wonderful novels by N.N. Wright, Catriona Lely, Sarah Baum, and others. The other is a larger project, which has been commissioned by Taylor and Francis, the Routledge Companion to Literature and the Arts. So I'm co-editing that with two of my colleagues at NTU, Professor Sneed Murphy and Cheryl Giulielli. So in that book, we assemble about 40 contributors to talk about the intersections between literature and the arts. So we've got a great group of contributors, and we're really excited about the essays. So that is, right now we're in the process of reviewing those essays at present. So hopefully those two projects will be out sometime next year or perhaps in 2024.
Thank you. I hope we see you again on the podcast, and all the best for your projects.
Thank you so much, Gargi. Thanks for having me.